It doesn't give me much freedom to tell any stories. But anyway, I'm sure they'll be able to work one in there somewhere. But in the meantime, actually, what about IT? And relationships? We're just talking at tea time with the monks the other day, and I told the story of this fellow. He was walking down the road, and he heard this frog speak. And the frog said, "I'm not a real frog. I'm this beautiful princess. Some wicked witch put a spell on me and turned me into a frog. If you would just give me one kiss, then I'll turn into a beautiful princess and do whatever you want." And this guy picked up the frog and put it in his pocket. And then a few minutes later, the frog, getting a bit upset, saying, "Hey, haven't you kissed me yet? And I'm a beautiful princess, I'm not a frog. You know, kiss me and I'll do whatever you like, anything." And he looked at it and put it back in his pocket. And after another couple of minutes, the frog said, "Look, please, I don't like being a frog. You know, kiss me and I'll turn into this beautiful princess, I'll marry you, do whatever you want, and I promise I'll never argue with you." And he took out the frog and said, "Listen, I'm in IT. I've got no time for relationships, but a talking frog is really cool." Is that okay? Anyway, back to the talk. I was supposed to be talking about insight, not jokes this morning. But you know, the insight into jokes. The reason why jokes are funny is that there's a lot of truth in them. And what we're laughing upon is ourselves, laughing upon our own stupidity. Which means we don't take things seriously. That's why I don't mind telling jokes and funny stories during meditation retreats or other talks, because you're highlighting parts of human nature which for some people could get you angry. And instead of responding with anger, we respond with laughter. And it's a much more wise response. So all those of you who've been really stupid during this retreat, who spent all the time sleeping, when you're in this room, you spend all the time planning or thinking. When I'm not there, you spend all the time talking. Whatever you're doing. You've got two choices. Get guilty, feel angry about it, or laugh at it. And when you laugh at it, it means you don't take it so seriously, which means you can let it go. Remember how easy it is, you know, I just told a joke, you let it go. Laughter is one of the great ways of letting things go. Getting angry is one great way of keeping it, so it festers and smoulders, and you can't get rid of it for a long time. So in life, one of the great insights is, whenever you do something wrong, you make a big mistake, tell everybody. That's what I do. You know, I told all those mistakes which I've made in my life. The Penang glass of whatever it was, some milky coffee. It was really delicious, you know, with ice creams turned all up. On the airport, I just finished a retreat, they were sending me off. And then they gave me this beautiful cup of milky coffee with ice cream, you know, frothed on the top. Really nice. And then, you know, they had a straw in it. I started sucking up the things through the straw, but the straw was blocked. So I sucked even harder. And that's when I said, you know, all the disciples, you know, you're so respectful, you don't dare laugh at me, so you put your hand up. And they're all giggling. I realized I was doing something wrong. And then I took out the straw and realized it wasn't a straw, it was a spoon. And I was sucking coffee through a spoon. Because it's one of these, you know, I don't go to modern coffee shops, so it's one of these little plastic things with only a tiny little flat piece on the bottom. You know, to me, spoons were always metal, so you could recognize what they were. And they just fooled me that time. But some of the best mistakes I made was doing chanting, because, you know, sometimes you do get tired because you work very hard. One marriage, which I did recently, you know, I was tired, and when I was doing the chanting, I realized halfway through, I wasn't doing the marriage chants, I was doing, you know what, funeral chants. So these people, I never told them, I don't know who they are, but, you know, they were chanting, given the funeral blessing at their marriage. I said I wouldn't say anything about marriages, but there we go. And they're still happily married. They're still together. It's amazing, just, you know, because in the monks' eyes, you know, like marriage and funerals, they're so close together. Okay, no more husband jokes. Anyway, so if you actually laugh at yourself, it means you don't hold it, you don't feel embarrassed or guilty, which means you can let things go. It's one of the ways of overcoming this fear which hides the truth, which hides insight. Sometimes that I wondered why it is that people lie to each other. And that's one of our precepts, okay? We're not supposed to lie. But why do people do that? So instead of just saying, this is a very good example of what insight is. Instead of just using, I'm going to restrain myself, I'm going to be mindful, I am never going to lie again, I'm going to keep my peace, I'm always going to tell the truth. Can that work? It never does work. Even if you may be a good Buddhist, you keep the five precepts, you may be an exco member of the BGF or the BF. Nevertheless, from time to time, you lie. Why is that? And one of the stories which made it very clear to me was there was a trial in the United States, and this guy was up for murder. And in that particular state, in the United States, murder still carried the death penalty. So if he was convicted, you know, he would be an electric chair. So during his testimony, it became very obvious he wasn't really telling the full truth. And so the judge interrupted and said, warned him. He said, sir, you know, during a trial you have to tell the truth. Do you not know the penalties for perjury, which is lying under oath? And the defendant says, yes, your honor, I know the penalties for perjury, and they're much less than the penalty for murder. Which is why he lied, because it was less of a penalty for him. Now, do you understand why many people lie in our modern world? Because the penalty is less than if you tell the truth. You get into more trouble if you tell the truth, which is why people decide they have to lie. So, when you understand the causes, the only way to overcome the preponderance of people telling lies in our world, especially in your family, like your kids. How can we stop them lying? The only way is to make it that it's less of a penalty for telling the truth than it is for lying, no matter what you've ever done. So as long as, if you tell the truth, it's less penalty, you're encouraging people to tell the truth. But now, if you tell the truth to your partner, if you tell the truth to your boss, if you tell the truth to your parents, too often you get scolded or punished. Which means it's not worth telling the truth. And it is fear of punishment drives the truth underground. Whether that's in politics, in business, or in a family. Fear of telling the truth. Which is, again, one of the other stories. Years ago, this young girl came up to me. She had been coming to our temple since she was very, very small. And actually just on Tuesday, this girl came, she's 23 now. She said her grandparents used to bring her to the temple when she was 4 or 5. And she still remembered the same old jokes I said. They said it was a very happy time for her. She remembered especially the story of the talkative tortoise, which is in Open the Door of Your Heart. And now she's a 4 or 5 year old girl at the time, and that's what's always stuck in her mind, very happy memories of coming to the temple. So like some of these kids, they come to the temple when they're very, very young, and they grow up with you, so they trust you. You're like almost like a godfather for them. You're just another member of the family. So this girl, I don't know how old she was, 17, 18 or something, she came up to me and said, I'm in big trouble, I'm pregnant. And I said, have you told your mum and dad yet? And she said, no, that's the point. They'll kill me if they found out, which is why I want you to tell them for me. You know, because the parents respected me and I could get her, you know, off the death penalty. But after that, obviously, I did that and got her out of trouble. But I always thought afterwards, what a terrible thing that is, that children are scared to tell their parents because they think they'll be punished. And especially when it's such an important thing for them, they're at a time when they really need their parents more than any other time. It could be like your son gets in trouble with the police, with drugs or whatever. And he's so afraid, he will hide it. Maybe he'll tell his other friends who are a fat lot of good. They want their parents to give them a hand. Which is why I encourage, whether it's husbands and wives, whether it's children and parents, whether it's, you know, disciples and teachers, always to tell the truth. And as long as you tell the truth, please tell the people you know, as long as you tell the truth, as long as you're honest, there's no punishment at all. So you're free. You feel not afraid to face the truth. And when you face the truth, then there's so many ways to deal with the problems, whether it's pregnancy or you get in trouble with the police. But when you hide the truth, you know, the problem festers again and again and again. And that's the same with even problems in meditation. There's too many people, they say, no, I don't fall asleep when I meditate. Of course, because you're not aware when you're doing that. So someone else says, excuse me, you're snoring. Oh, no, not me, I don't snore. So one of the nice things is actually to have this trust and respect to honesty so much that you don't feel afraid of being honest, which is the first step to insight. You can actually see things and you're not hiding things. The trouble with delusion, it is a form of lying. You only see what you want to see. You only hear what you want to hear. And what is too uncomfortable for you, you don't see, you don't hear. So you can understand that insight takes a lot of honesty, lack of fear, and great trust. The trust that as long as you're honest, upfront, you admit your mistakes, that there can be progress. And that's precisely what the Buddha said time and time again in the sutras. It's one of the things which inspired me to be a Buddhist when I was only 16. You know, to read that there was a fellow who said, all you need to do if you make a mistake, big or small, is to acknowledge it. Either tell yourself or tell someone else, a good friend, acknowledge it. No punishment, amnesty. And the most important stage, learning from it. You make a mistake, you learn from it, so you don't need to make it again. You put strategies in place so that you don't get yourself in that situation where you have to lie again. In a marriage, if there's some person that you really feel attracted to at work, you know, you make sure you don't meet with them, especially alone. You know, you have that separation there. You put strategies in place so you don't lose it. If it's, you always tend to get angry at people. You know, you try and never go and speak to them when you're tired, when you're in a bad mood, because you know that anger is more likely to come out then and you regret it. So you work out all these strategies in your life so that you're honest with your mistakes and weaknesses, so those weaknesses do not cause you any problem. For example, if you're honest that when you get up in the morning you always tend to fall asleep, when you sort of meditate, put strategies in place. In other words, don't wake up. No, don't do that one. What you can do is actually take some of the blankets off or the jumpers off, because when you're cold, not too cold to the fact you get sick, you find it's much harder to fall asleep. So a simple strategy, first of all, be honest with yourself and then put strategies in place. Sometimes we think, oh, we can deal with this, you know, I can sort of break through the sleepiness. But if you can't, be honest with it and just try and ask a question to find out all these wonderful methods to overcome these problems. So that honesty is, again, the first step to learning. But it never works if we always feel guilty and we feel, I'm hopeless, I can't meditate, I can't chant, I can't get up in the morning, I'm hopeless. You're punishing yourself. That never works. So instead, we just admit who we are and our failings, and we put strategies in place. we learn how to deal with who we are. And that is precisely how we deal with, again, the problems in meditation as well. We understand where we get stuck sometimes. And we try and learn strategies. But we're at least honest, first of all. When we have that honesty, we can actually see what's going on. Sometimes, though, actually you did ask me some time ago about mindfulness, a definition of it. And I gave the definition of basic mindfulness, which is just being in this present moment and being silent. But you know, even that, you're not really seeing the truth. Even there, you are being selective of what you hear and what you see, what you think. So real mindfulness, the mindfulness where you can trust that what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're feeling, what you're knowing is actually the truth, and rather than some deception, is when you have known of the five hindrances in your mind. Because whenever there's desire, you won't see the truth. You will see what you want to see, not what's really there. Which is sometimes why, because people are deluded, they buy lottery tickets. Why do people buy lottery tickets? It's because they're deluded that they can have this trick, that they are superior than other people. They know the special temple, they know the special chart, they know the special monk. And if they do this little ceremony, that they can beat the odds. It's amazing how many people think that they are different and special. They can go to the casino or to horse racing and they can win. See, that's the conceit of stupidity. They're only seeing what they want to see, and of course they keep losing. Or we get this terrible like anger which we have, which is also distorts the truth. You know, the ill will. If you get really upset at someone, it could be one of your parents, they've given you a hard time. Sometimes you can't see any good quality in them whatever. All you can see is what justifies your anger. They're a pig. It's obvious they're a pig. Look at them. Look how fat they are. So whatever it is, you see what you want to see, and you hear what you want to hear, which is what happens with, you know, the delusion when the five hindrances are working. So what we need to do, if we really want to be mindful and get insight and see things as they truly are, not what we want to see them as, we have to somehow suppress these five hindrances so that we're clear, bright. You know that old story, I can't help but it's going somewhere with relationships. You know that old story about, I say, where do people fall in love? If you've got a husband or a wife, or you had one, where did you fall in love? It was usually on somewhere romantic. Such as a nightclub. Or, even better, a candlelit dinner. Have you ever been to a candlelit dinner in a fine restaurant? Isn't that romantic? Or, like we had the last few days, a walk under the moonlight. How more romantic can you get than that? Except a candlelit dinner in a nightclub in the moonlight. But when I started reflecting on this, you know, when I used to go out with girls, I thought, what have those four places all got in common? And what they all had in common were, they were dark. And why does that make it romantic? Because in the darkness, you can look at that ordinary looking girl right in front of you, and she looks like a supermodel. You know, because the dark, you can't really see her properly. You can't see her dark teeth and pimples. The same with the boy. In the moonlight, or just with the flickering candlelight on his face, you can imagine, you can see what you want to see. He looked just like Brad Pitt. He looks just like Justin Bieber. He does, look at it. Because that's what you want to see. And the lack of light means that your imagination can warp reality. You can see what you want to see. And that's when you fall in love. And then when you get divorced, you can't see anything good in that person. all those wonderful things you saw when you met, you can't see them anymore. In fact, you see the opposite. Both were there to begin with, but now you're seeing what you really want to see because you're upset. So, whenever you have these hindrances, they always stop you getting insight. You don't see what's out there, you see what you want to see. And you're afraid of seeing the truth. So when you actually slow these hindrances down, suppress them, you actually start seeing what's real, what's out there. And it can be a bit scary at times, because you're seeing things which you never expected to see. But you are honest enough, realizing that honesty, it doesn't matter how unpleasant it is, that is the best way of growth. And again, I was going to mention, in the Buddhist suttas it said, if you do a fault, if there's something wrong, admit it, forgive it, learn from it, and that is called growth in Buddhism. That's progress on the spiritual path. Admitting, forgiving, learning. So when we can do this, we do this as a way of finding insight, not just for the sake of knowing the truth, but the sake of growing as a human being, both healthily, physically, emotionally, and also spiritually, to become more wise and compassionate. So I already mentioned to you yesterday, you know, a lot of people think they know what compassion is, but they don't. You know, they're not mindful enough, they haven't suppressed the hindrances, so now they're deluded. We think we know, but we don't. And you tell a person, you're not compassionate. Yes, I am. I am compassionate. I support Firefly. I go over to Burma. I support Nuns Monastery. I support so many things. I am compassionate. And you find you're not very compassionate because you've been hitting your knees for the last 5 minutes, compassionate to everybody else, but not compassionate to yourself. You haven't understood what compassion is or what kindness is. So too many people get deluded that way. That's why we meditate, calm the hindrances down, so there's no desire, no ill will. The first two hindrances. What does that mean? No desire means let it be, make peace. That's called no desire, letting go of trying. This is calming the hindrance down. Loving kindness, the door of my heart's open. Even to that person who keeps banging the door, who keeps letting off wind, because that seems to be the theme of this retreat. My door, my heart's open to all of these people. Now that's overcoming the second hindrance. And the making peace stops the restlessness. Sloth and pauper, that just goes by itself if you do the other three. And doubt, the first hindrance I talked about, understanding what is really good and what is worthwhile, what is part of this path. When you understand all of that, these hindrances vanish, but especially the first two, desire and ill will. That's what bends the truth. Which is why I've been teaching for years. It's just like you ask Ajahn Siddhartha and Ajahn Brahmali and all these Western monks, we all agree on this, that you need to calm the mind out of those five hindrances before you have a chance to do insight meditation. In that sense, no such thing as insight meditation before you can have insight. Without stillness, without calming these hindrances, if your mind is still restless, if there's still desire and ill will, you can never really see things truly. You think you do, that's part of delusion. And one of the signs that you've seen things is you don't have too many desires, or you don't get upset or angry. Which is why I said that's how we test out if a person's enlightened or not. Try and make them angry. I was talking about this in monastery at tea time, and they say how you can find out if a person's enlightened is whether they put jam on their toast. Shows they've got desire. So you put marmalade on my beverage this morning, and I took the marmalade. Oh, I can't be enlightened. Oh, no, that's not the way you find out. But anyway, it wasn't jam, it was marmalade, so I'm free. So this is how we can see things, to actually to suppress these things. And if you find out you've been doing some meditation and you get angry and upset afterwards, you can't be really understanding what meditation is. The hindrances are still there. I've already mentioned that part of the job of meditation is to let go of the five senses, but it's also to let go of the hindrances. And how can you let go of craving? Through craving. I'm going to let go of all my desires. I'm going to have no ill will. That's ill will towards ill will, which really makes you tense. That is not the way of meditation. But what you've actually heard here, the way of calming this mind down, settling it by making peace, being kind, being gentle, just letting things be, you can understand that actually stops the mind from wanting things, wanting anything, even good states. It stops the mind from getting upset. You know, any demon which comes into your palace, you welcome it. You see, this is stopping the very cause of lies, the cause of distortions. You know, you are valuing the truth so much and you are calming down the causes for bending the truth. And once you get the causes out of lack of insight, of delusion, out of the way, of course, then you can trust what you see, what you hear. So when you have no desire or ill will, that's why when people come, those of you who've come to interviews, hope you've noticed by now, whatever you tell me, I always say, very good. And you come and tell me that, I haven't really been meditating at all. I've just been in my hut, you know, I've got 3G, and I've just been checking the internet and watching movies all week. And I tell you? Very good. And the monks over in Bodhinyana recognize that. They say it's so easy to give interviews following the Ajahn Brahm method. Whoever comes in there says, I've just been a psychopath, I've just killed the other person in the room, just say, very good. I just become enlightened. Very good. And you've heard me do that, some of you. So why do I do that? Again, because you want to encourage people to actually bring up the truth. You know, to have none of this ill will coming from me and feelings of guilt. I know some of these Zen masters, even in an interview, they have a big stick next to them. That's really scary. But apparently they stopped doing that because when I was in Hong Kong a year or two ago, in Hong Kong there's many monks coming over from mainland China and they're having breakfast together and, you know, gossiping, you know, just like you gossip, monks gossip as well. Find out what's going on. And he told this incredible story. He said, in one of the big Zen monasteries in mainland China, one of the teachers is quite well known in China. He was teaching a retreat, and one of these women came up for the interview, and she obviously gave the wrong answer, and he hit her with the Zen stick. You know, that's tradition in Zen monasteries. But she called the police on her cell phone, and had the monk arrested for assault. And the police said, I don't care whether it's Buddhist tradition, been done for thousands of years or not. This is modern China, you can't do that. So they took the monk to jail. But we can't do that anymore. So anyway. So that's why, you know, but if you did have a Zen stick or something, you know, you'd just be answering out of fear. There wouldn't be no honesty, no insight coming out. You'd be afraid of the truth. And that's the whole point of like suppressing these hindrances. So even fear disappears, which allows the truth to come up. Yesterday I mentioned that talk I gave at the BF many years ago where Soon Han, the president, couldn't sleep at night. It was just too scary for him. Because that's what scariness does, it actually suppresses the truth. And I am going to say about ghosts now, because please, this is not a scary story. This is actually the truth. The truth is, ghosts are more scared of you than you are of them. That is the truth. Of course, we don't like to admit that, but you know, if ever you do really get some powers and can be able to see ghosts, they will run away. because you know you've understood them. They are lower beings. You're a much higher being. I compare it to the mouse and the elephant. I've never seen this, but people tell me that elephants are afraid of mice. That's ridiculous. The elephant is a huge being. How can a mouse do any harm to an elephant? But still the elephant's afraid. And to me that's the same case. How can a ghost do any harm to you? It's just like the mouse and the elephant, that's what it is. If the elephant wanted to squash, and that's the end of the mouse. The mouse couldn't do that to the elephant. Same with you, you can squash ghosts if you ever want to. Now that's the truth. But you've got to overcome your fear to see the truth, which is one of the biggest problems of insight. It takes a lot of courage. Sometimes, again, people ask me, because they know enough about Buddhism, about where is, in Ajahn Brahm's method of meditation, where is this important factor, number 6 of the Eightfold Path, called right effort? Because you're telling us to sit here and do nothing. Where's the effort? Surely you've got to sit here, you've got to fight the defilements, you've got to conquer the mind, you've got to make the mind concentrated, you've got to do this and do that, you've got to have effort. And you're just saying, you know, if you want to sleep, go and sleep. You know, if you want to watch the internet, that's very good. If you want to talk, even there's supposed to be no silence, okay. Where's the effort? Now where the effort is, again, the actual word in Pali is called virya. And a long time ago, I noticed there's a connection between virya and viro, which was the Pali word for a hero. It just means like heroics. And the word of a hero in those days, which was the days of military and agriculture, so most of the similes are either about armies, generals, or agriculture, paddy fields. And it was called a hero because whether it was a heroic elephant or horse or soldier, they would be willing to sacrifice everything with no fear for their own safety, you know, for the cause, for their king. And that made it very clear what this right effort is. It's not the effort to attain, but the effort to sacrifice everything, especially your life, but not really your physical life, your sense of self and who you are. That is the right effort in Buddhism, the virya, which is part of the path. It really is that great courageous act to let go. And of course many of you have found it very difficult to let go because you haven't had enough courage yet. There's still that little bit of fear left. You're not willing to sacrifice everything. Like they say, the king's best elephant, who doesn't worry about protecting itself from arrows and spears, will just go into battle, exposing all parts of its body out of love for the king. Now that is that heroic, sacrificial effort, which is what is part of the Eightfold Path. It is what I call the courage to let go. And it's a tough thing to do, because a lot of times you have to have some faith and trust, like the soldiers do, you know, in the cause, in patriotism, in the monarch or whatever. If you have that type of confidence, it's worth doing. I'm going to do this, I'm going to let go. It's scary, but I'm going for it. Then you'll find that you'll get the insights into what is the nature of this world and how all these things fit together. You start to understand the Dhamma. So it takes a bit of courage. So, how does that courage actually work in practice, in your meditation? You get this wonderful insight that you come across barriers in meditation and you don't want to go further. It's not that you haven't got the understanding, it's not you haven't got the energy. You're just too afraid to go to that next step. Fear is one of the great underlying barriers to progress in meditation. It's not that you can't, it's just you don't want to. It's not you can't watch the breath, but you don't want to. There's a fear there of what would happen if I did. So what you usually do, you follow the method of the little kid who goes to the swimming pool for the first time in its life. This little kid has only just learned to walk on solid ground. Now his mother or father takes him to a swimming pool, and that's really strange stuff. It's always moving, it's not solid. So you can imagine, just imagine how scary that would be for a kid to be faced with water. So what the mother does, the kid's not going to go in, it's going to be screaming. And the mother takes his foot and just dips her toe in and takes it out. That's okay, that's actually quite nice. Put a foot in, wiggle it around, take it out, that's alright. Then a leg, put it in, take it out. Then two legs, sitting on the edge. That's fun. And then the mother pushes it in, and it goes all the way in. And once it's in the water, splashing around, having the time of its life, the poor mother can't get the kid out of the pool. They're having too much fun. And that's exactly the way we overcome these obstacles of fear in our meditation. Don't push it too hard. Don't say, no, I must go in, I must go in. Just go in a tiny bit. Just put a toe in and see what it's like. That's nice. I can let go a little bit. I'm coming out again afterwards. Let go a little bit more. That's all right. A little bit more. That's actually quite nice. And then you go in and you can't come out. You're having too much of a time. It's something like the delightful breath. You've let go of the body. It's scary. You've let go of all ideas of time. That's a bit sort of worrisome. But you go in and it's fun. So go in a little bit, come out, go in a little bit more, come out, go in a little bit more, come out, until you're comfortable. That is the way we overcome fear. Just inch by inch, toe by toe, and realizing the joy of this letting go. When we do that, we find out that this barrier of fear, which is one of the things which block a lot of the progress in our meditation, that this is the way it's overcome. We have insight into the path, insight into how to meditate, how to let go, how to be peaceful. And that's one of the most important insights to have. The insights of how to get insight. The insight into the path, the insight in how to meditate. Which is why I spend most of all my lectures on meditation retreats not on telling you what dependent origination is, Four Noble Truths, not telling you what you're going to find at the end of the path, but telling you how to get to that end of the path, how to meditate, how to let go, how to make your mind peaceful, how to overcome those hindrances so insight can come out. So you just let go of the body. Tough thing to do for many people, but it's fun when you do it. You let go of thinking. That is your, what they call your safety blanket, your thinking. In other words, you feel comfortable with thinking. You've got some sense of control over your body, over your life, over your future. When I take that away, you feel exposed. But you let go of thinking a little bit more, a little bit more. It feels good. So I should actually have told you, whenever you do have any success in meditation, even a small amount of success, so you can just watch the breath for a minute, or you know you've got some silence in the mind for a few seconds. Please reflect on how it feels. To know what it's like to be still, to be peaceful, just to be focused on one thing. Remember what it's like. This is how you get that courage to have insight into the beauty and the joy of letting go. And every little letting go you get is a greater joy, a greater happiness. You just let go of this past and future and you feel free. It's a happy feeling of freedom. You've got no worries, no past to bother you anymore, no future to worry about. You feel just so free. Or you get let go of, you know, the thinking. And it's like that story of karaoke. You feel so free of this, yeah, always going on in your head. And like those two monsters were born in your head. They're not really supposed to be there. You know, you're abducted by aliens and they put these two little monsters in you. And you know what, one of those, actually there's three monsters in your head. One of those monsters is called past, the other one is called future, the other one is called thinking. They're monsters, they don't belong in you. And they cause so much problems and troubles for you. You know, worrying about the past, this monster of what's going to happen in the future, this monster of thinking. And then somehow or other you can take these monsters out. Imagine they're coming out of your head. Ah, what freedom. Because these monsters are always talking. They're much worse than you guys. I've seen you always talking, but the monsters inside your head, they really never stop, even when you're alone, when you're sleeping. Always talking to you. Never shut up. So if you can actually calm those down, take them out, ah, what a beautiful relief. Please reflect every time you get any slight success in meditation, how it feels. It's beautiful, it's wonderful, it's lovely. Thank you so much. Because that's like the kid putting their toe in a swimming pool. It feels good. They're going to put more of their foot in the swimming pool the next time. They're going to go deeper when they realize it's happy, safe, nothing to be afraid of. So you just go a bit deeper and a bit deeper every time. And you get to this delightful breath thing. Many of you can get to the breath, but you haven't got to the delightful breath. Why? Because you're afraid of letting go. There's a blockage there, a fear. You know, I don't want to go any further, this is good enough for me. Even though some of you, because of pride, you want to attain something and get something to, usually just to tell your friends. Because you know what happens after the retreat? You know, you go back home on the plane, say, what did you do? And you say, oh, I got to the beautiful breath. Beautiful breath, that's nothing. I got that the first day. I got to Nimittas. Nimittas? Oh, come on. I got it. It reminds me of the story of the four Catholic women. Here we go. This is not about husbands. It's not about brothers or girls. This is about sons. Is that okay? Okay, there you go, about sons. So these four women were having a cup of coffee. And one of them, they were good friends. And one of them was boasting about their son. Said, my son, he got ordained as a Catholic priest today, or yesterday. I'm so proud of him. Because when women see him, they bow their heads and they call him father, even though he's only 23. I'm so proud of him. And the other woman, she said, ah, only a father, that's nothing, nothing. My son, he's a bishop. He wears this ring. When women see him, they bend down and kiss his ring. And they call him, what is it, your grace. And the third woman, sipping her coughing sniff. My son was a bishop years ago. He is now cardinal. Where women come to the room, they get on their knees and they call him your eminence. And the last woman was just sipping her coffee. And they're all looking at her. And when she finished, she says, that's nothing. My son is 24 years of age, 6'3", blonde, blue hair, blonde, blue eyes, drop dead gorgeous. He plays soccer for Manchester United. Whenever any girl sees him, they drop to the ground and say, oh my God, my God, my God. So is that an allowable joke? I got away with that. Okay, pretty good. So that's just pride about, and we don't have that sort of pride in this. It doesn't matter, don't go around achieving this and achieving that comparing. But a lot of times people are so into achievements because they think they've got to tell other people what they've been doing for the last 8 or 9 days. So that is what makes you afraid. So just let go of all fear of failure, and all fear of letting go of things. And the more you let go of fear, the more happy and free you feel. It's amazing how many prisons of fear you live in life. We are made to feel afraid. Now, ever since we were little kids, afraid of failure, afraid of not being liked or loved, not being respected, afraid of not being good enough, afraid that somewhere, something inside of you is imperfect. There's some genetic deformation in you, which is why you can't get a husband, why you can't get a wife, why you can't get jhanas, why you can't get... There's nothing wrong with you! You are all the same, except for you. So have that wonderful courage in this meditation to allow the truth to come up. No punishment, no judgments, no I'm terrible, I'm hopeless. Just let all of that disappear. So you're not trying to attain to please anybody, least of all yourself. And certainly not me, because whatever you do, I'll always say very good. You know, one person said, I've been sleeping all 9 days, I'll say very good. The next one, I say, got fourth jhana psychic powers, today I got fully enlightened. I'll give exactly the same response, very good. I promise. And you do that so you don't judge people. And they said, judging causes a fear. It's the fear which hides the truth, which stops insight arising. So, no judgments, no fear, which means you have this beautiful sense of self-sacrifice, courage, just to see what happens. Which means the meditation gets very, very deep. Very easily. You just let go and see what happens. And again, sometimes you do have some weird experiences. People sometimes talk about their weird experiences. I love weird experiences. Because life as a monk is sometimes so boring. You're not allowed to watch movies. You're not allowed to see the TV. So, you know, it can be quite boring sometimes when you see, like, the walls melt like chocolate. Wow, that's really nice. You know, you meditate, you feel your body start to expand. We have these limiters of these psychic jewels with Hindu monks. That's so much fun. So anything weird which happens in your meditation, enjoy it. Get into it, because there's this time of meditation. I'm really going all around the place now, but this is basically on insight. This is that time in meditation where the body is starting to disappear. And, you know, it's almost like pre-nimitta, or just, you know, a very complicated nimitta stage when the body disappears, when you can start to have all these little visions. It's just, the mind is just playing around. So you're not just seeing one light, you can see all sorts of scenarios playing out, and that's when sometimes people feel that they're rising into the air, their body's expanding, or like Ajahn Chah's simile, which he wrote about, his body exploding. Like a liver over here and a heart on another part of the tree. That's really weird, but that's really cool. You know, it's really interesting. It never really exploded. He came out of meditation, everything was in its right place again. It wasn't like an autopsy. It was just these wonderful visions which you have in meditation. I call it just the mind, it's like, becomes free from all these constraints which you have, telling you how to see and how to view things and how to hear things. We're so constrained by our cultural upbringing. And at this particular stage, you're really letting go of all those cultural indoctrination, those boundaries which you've learned, only to see things in one way. And now you can see things in ways which are really weird. To me, it's really important to have those experiences, enjoy them, and just to show you, you can see things in totally different ways. Walls don't have to be solid. You don't have to be just the same size. You can go thinner, you can go fatter, all sorts of stuff. It's just the way you're perceiving it. You are not going crazy. You don't need to be taken back to Singapore in a straitjacket. This is, you don't need any medication. This is the natural way that the mind enjoys a little bit of freedom from the constraints of perception. You have these wonderful experiences. So don't be afraid. Enjoy them to the max. Usually they only last about 5 minutes, if less. It's a shame because they get really interesting sometimes. And then you can just calm down. You usually get beautiful nimittas after that. But the point is, never be afraid. Because this meditation is perfectly, 100% absolutely safe. The only dangers in meditation is when you do those meditations with force. And I've seen too many victims, they really force their mind, I'm going to really watch the breath, I'm going to focus, I'm going to sit here with 100% effort. That's dangerous, because sometimes, you know, that some people's minds are fragile and that's too much for them, and they break, they crack. But this type of meditation, which is so peaceful and calm and gentle and kind, you've got absolutely no worries. This is the safest way you can spend an hour, or 2 hours, or 10 hours, or whatever. 100%. Good. So you don't have to be afraid. So when those things happen, be courageous, let them happen. What it's showing you, you're getting the insight into just how conditioned, how narrow is the human perception. We just can't see wide enough to see the truth. We're just like the horses, they're blinkered, they're only allowed to see a certain type of truth. You can understand with the people of different religions, always thinking that my religion is the truth, my politics is the only way, my way of doing things is the only way. They're just so narrow. And what's happening here, all those blinkers are taken off so the mind can just play, explore into weird stuff. And then it finishes. So that's important, just to understand how perception works. And it's not you, it's just perception playing around. It settles down and comes to normal afterwards, but you have a great time. And the next thing which happens, of course, you get these incredible nimittas. And they are scary. The reason they are scary, sometimes the insight, why? You have this beautiful light, incredible bliss, why doesn't it stay? And it's because, it's to stay there, you have to let go of your controlling. This little thing inside of you, a lot of people, you have been hurt, each one of us has been hurt sometimes, and the response to being hurt is that we want to control in our immediate environment, because we've been hurt too many times already. So we react by being more of a control freak. The more pain a person has had in their life, usually the more controlling they become. And after a while one gets to trust other people, relax and let go. I love giving the simile of the child. I've seen this many times in shopping centers. I used to, the travel agent I used to go to was in the middle of a shopping center. Now I can do it on the internet, it's much better, but in those days, the shopping centers are the worst place in the world for a monk. And mostly because just such coarse sounds and smells and sights. And if you've been in a monastery, it's just so jagged and so hard, like being pricked by all this sensory input. It's really nasty. So I had to go in there because the travel agent was right in the middle. So I was at the gates, head down, straight ahead to get until you got into the travel agent. But I did sometimes see these women, they had a baby in their arms and a shopping trolley and their handbag in their other arms. Now, trying to negotiate busy shopping centres, bumping into all sorts of people. And that baby was fast asleep. And I couldn't imagine, how can a baby go to sleep like that when it's in imminent danger of being bumped, dropped onto the hard floor? You know, if I was being carried, I would never be able to go to sleep. I'd be worried sick. I'd be so anxious. But that baby trusts its mother 100%. And we really mean 100%. It knows it's not going to be dropped. So it can go fast asleep with not a care or a fear in the world. I always say that's a type of trust which we need to develop in meditation. 100% trust to let go and allow yourself to disappear so you're not controlling at all. The Dharma will look after you. That will actually make you go very peaceful. It will always protect you. Which means that when this beautiful nimitta comes up, don't be afraid of it. Mummy Dhamma is holding you and you will not fall. You'll be fine. And that means that nimitta can actually stay with you for a long period of time. Fear is a problem. Fear comes from control. Control comes from a sense of self. And you get insight into that. And these are insights which not just get you into really deep meditation. It answers the other question which is often in the box in the evening. Yeah, but what happens when I go home and have to go to work? What happens when you go to work? You know much more about how to let go. You know especially how to live without fear, how to not control. You've been doing that in the meditation and it works. You actually try that with the people who work with you. Instead of trying to control them, you work with them. If there's a problem in the office, some terrible boss is always giving you a hard time, instead of trying to figure out ways to get rid of the guy, you say, "Welcome, boss. Thank you so much, Mr. Monster, for coming to visit my palace. And your boss, who was once a boss from hell, becomes this beautiful, wonderful little boss, just because you change your attitude. Remember Venerable Hui Can? She goes sometimes to BF. She told me this great story. It's mother-in-law's, but it's not a joke. I was banned from saying anything about mothers-in-laws, but there was this Chinese girl, married an English guy, Australian guy, sorry, and even though she was really, really, really trying hard to get on with her husband's mother, it was always a very difficult relationship. And the mother whatever her daughter-in-law did, it was never, ever good enough for her son. And she felt always unappreciated, even though she worked so hard. She always felt rejected. She always felt not good enough whenever she saw her mother-in-law, her father's mother, her husband's mum. And so she tried all sorts of things. She started praying to the Buddha for help. She started meditating, loving kindness meditation, all sorts of stuff. And nothing ever worked. But apparently what happened, that she went to the temple one day, the Mahayana temple, in front of a statue of Kuan Yin, and she started meditating and fell asleep. And she had this nimitta, this sign, of Kuan Yin came to her in her dreams. You know the typical Kuan Yin, with the robe and little vase and stuff? But what really shocked her, the image of Kuan Yin, everything was just like you see in the temple except the face, which was her mother-in-law. And that was the solution. When she came out, she remembered that image, and every time she saw her mother-in-law, she imagined, the body of Kuan Yin around her. And so she related to her mother like Kuan Yin. And within a couple of months, her relationship totally changed, and her mother-in-law loved her, and she loved her, and they had this beautiful relationship again. So that's how you can do with your boss. Imagine a boss's face with a beautiful Kuan Yin image. If you're not a Mahayana Buddhist, with a beautiful Ajahn Brahm sort of smile. It totally changes. So this is a changing of your perceptions, how you look at these things. So what you actually learn here with messing around with your perceptions actually works when you get back home. Yeah, you can't meditate as deep here, deep there as you do here, but when you get home, this incredible amount of insights you learn in this path of meditation, which quite naturally you will apply to your life. For those of you who have the misfortune to get cancers, you've got a tumor in your breast or in your prostate or something. Oh, what should I do with it? Tumor, the door of my heart is open to you. Come in. My body is big enough for both of us. Especially my body. Come in, welcome. That attitude takes away all the negativity, all the stress, all the fear which feeds that monster in your body. And you learn that here. How to let things be, how to accept them, how to embrace them. And then when you go back home, whatever happens to you in your life, my goodness, you really are empowered. This is what I understand as insight meditation. Practical insights. The deeper insights when it gets to enlightenment and stuff, they will come later on. But all these insights, the ones which work, which are useful, they come when you're learning how to calm the mind down, how you're trying to find out how to watch the breath, how you're trying to find out how to get joy in your heart, how you're working out, for those of you who have nimittas, how to stabilize that nimitta, how to get it to work. All of those little tests, they are not just for meditation. They work in your life in an amazing way. So what you're doing here is insight meditation. 100%. Don't ever think, okay, my mind is peaceful enough now I'm going to do insight. Come on, you've been doing insight all the time. This is all insight meditation, understanding your mind, your body, how it works, and how to deal with it, and these amazing ways. of overcoming fear, overcoming control, letting things be, being kind, being gentle, the importance of peace, and that works so well in your everyday life. There we go. It's a very good cup of tea this morning. That's why I've been speaking too much. So thank you all for listening. We're going to have interviews now, so off you go and put these things into practice.